Hello and welcome to the Classicists podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the Classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Eli Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. All right, Victor, so let's start here. There's still lots going on the COVID front, and I want to start this week with the president. A word came out at the end of last week that President Trump was thinking about backing off of the daily White House press conferences. And what we've seen so far is it's more kind of a modification. They're doing things not in the briefing room. It's a little bit different. But you wrote at National Review that you think he's right to reassess this, but that the remedy is not just to pull the president off stage. It's to entirely overhaul these events to a somewhat different end. Walk us through that.
Yeah, I think I try to make an argument on a number of levels. The first is that we're rapidly evolving into a social, cultural, political, economic, military crisis, and not just a medical one. By that I mean, as the cases, I think, were continually decline, or they level off, both here in Europe, and there is some indication we're getting more effective antidotes, pharmaceuticals for the virus, and despite the denials, it does seem that warm weather, if you look at what the experience of California, Florida, and Texas have been compared to the New England, it must play some role, and it's getting warmer. So I think it's now more of a multifaceted challenge, and that should be reflected in the press conferences, that Birx and Fauci should get 2 to 3, 5 minutes, but then go to Mnuchin or the Council of Economic Advisors, and then get the Joint Chiefs or the Secretary of Defense to come in and talk about Iran harassing our boats, ships in the Persian Gulf or Straits of Hormuz, or the Chinese doing the same, or Chinese illegal nuclear testing, just to reassure people that we're still on guard, talk about the USS Roosevelt, and then have Pence come in and sum up all of those for his 3 or 4 minutes, add something, and then Trump can be kind of a master of ceremonies, and then direct questions to these experts. And the net result of that would be he wouldn't be drawn into these gotcha ambush questions by the White House press corps, whose intent is to get him off track, get him angry, get a soundbite for the network news in the evening. And he wins those. Usually he makes them look pretty stupid, but those are Pyrrhic tactical victories, not strategically effective, because they don't advance his cause, because they're taken out of context. And whether it's, you know, it reappears as Trump wants everybody to drink Lysol, or Trump called this person a communist, or whatever it is, it's all going to be warped. Whereas I know they do that anyway, but I think if he did it succinctly every other day rather than an hour or two per day, it would help him a lot more. And then there's an effort on the part of the media to, I guess, flip Fauci and Birx to, with a wink and nod, say to them, we know you're the adults in the room and you really can't stand Trump, and then we're going to put you on CNN or MSNBC or ABC over the weekend, and you can kind of... So it's not a healthy relationship. And finally, I suggested that they did this in 2017. I think in Skype and Zoom, that would be a good excuse in this era of the lockdown to bring in people from the Midwest, reporters, media people, radio talk show hosts, just to ask a question for everyone the White House correspondents ask. Because you know what's really funny is that there's all these questions, and we really don't want to know if Trump believes that the dead are somehow comparable to the war dead in Vietnam, and he's therefore responsible for this tragedy. What I want to know, and I think most of the country want to know, is why does Texas have such a small per capita fatality rate per million people, and California and Florida? And what does the data show what happens when you open up Florida or Georgia compared to states that remain in lockdown? What are some of the new drugs that are out there, and are there testing, and et cetera, et cetera. But the media has no curiosity other than if they can leverage those issues to score political points. And as we get down to November, each day closer, you're going to see this weaponization of the whole issue get more and more acute.
there seems to be a sense in a lot of places, certainly in the New York area where I am, of the pressure letting up a little. I mean, here life is not back to normal by any stretch. Most of the businesses are still closed. People are still in their homes. At this point, it's sort of about small mercies, parks being reopened and things like that. But people are maybe beginning to exhale a bit. But of course, there's an awful lot still ahead of us in terms of getting the economy back on its feet, figuring out how to best combat the virus. And at National Review, you called this the coronavirus project, intentionally evoking the Manhattan Project. And I'd love for you to do for us here what you did in that column, which is to put this in the context of some of the other occasions in American history where we've had to launch massive mobilizations on this scale. How does this compare?
Well, it's extraordinary because whether it was the B-29 project in today's dollars, $40 billion, or the Manhattan, probably $28 billion, or the interstate highway system was probably $500 billion, or I think the joint fighter, the F-35, will probably end up at $1 trillion or more, or the war on drugs, or the war on smoking, or the space program, which is probably in its aggregate $1 trillion. We've never seen such a thing so costly, whether it's the $1 or $2 trillion added to the annual deficit, or the dislocations in the economy, or the experiment with paying people in some cases more to stay home than they can earn in the job, or the destruction of liquidity in the stock market, or loss of GDP. You add it all up and it's going to be several trillion dollars. And usually we had a zero, you start at zero with the Mercury program and you end up with a man on the moon, or you start with a designer designing a B-29 and you end up over Tokyo with this huge bomber, or you start out with, you know, a third of males dying of lung cancer and you get it down to 12% or something. But here nobody is saying this is what we're going to do. The president's very upbeat, but he's called unduly optimistic. But what I'm getting at is that all of those efforts were deeply embedded with optimism and can do. And we're going from A, we're getting to Z. In this case, it's don't let down your guard. It's going to come back and it's going to be worse in the fall. We don't think that even if you have antibodies, you've got immunity. There's some cases in Korea where it comes back and bites you. I don't think this hydroxychloroquine have any value at all. It's probably worse than nothing. And this is going to be, 2 million dead. Oh, no, it's 300,000. No, 200,000. Well, maybe 100,000. And what I'm getting at is not only in a lot of cases they're wrong, like it does seem that antibodies do provide immunity and you don't get it twice, and yet we lived with that, but there's a deeply embedded pessimism, and I don't know whether that's a lack of confidence in this baby boomer generation that fades out, or it's weaponizing the debate for the election in November, and they're illustrative of their anti-Trump antipathy. I just know that you don't go into Tokyo Bay on the Missouri, or you don't cross the Rhine with the Third Army with an attitude like that. It just doesn't work. At some point, everybody's got to go together and say, we're going to beat this damn little virus, and we're going to have local control and regional control, and where it works, by letting people out, we're going to learn from it in the Swedish model in Florida or Colorado, and where it won't work right now in New York, we're going to make it work soon. And we're not getting that. And the press conferences are indicative of that. It's doom and gloom, and we can't do this, we can't do that, and we have to be 99.999 sure before we even, walk out our front door. And it's timidity and it's hesitancy. And it's tentativeness. Boy, if we had the same attitude, we would have, after the Gemini crash or one of the problems on Apollo 11, I think it was, or we would have just quit.
I want to pick up here on something that you've mentioned in passing in a couple of pieces. You mentioned it in passing early on in that answer as well. As we work through this period where the government is appropriating massive amounts of money to keep the private sector from totally cratering, you're hearing lots of people say, well, yeah, it's a lot of cash, but, you know, it's a low, virtually no interest rate environment. And if this is what it takes, it's what it takes. And obviously, it's hard to fathom how we'd get through something like the past few months without some sort of massive government support. But that said, the acceptance of that necessity in a lot of people seems to carry with it oftentimes a somewhat blithe disregard for what this is doing in terms of a national debt problem that was already quite substantial before we got to this point. Am I right to sense that you are a little more uneasy about that part of the equation and what it means about the way the world looks after this?
Yeah, I'm a lot more uneasy than I ever have been about the debt. I understand the reasoning. The reason, as I understand it from some economists and policymakers as well, there's no liquidity because one day a guy wakes up with $100,000 in his 401k and he's taken some out. And the next day he's got 60. And therefore that money was burned up. It's gone. And therefore if we print some or we quantitatively ease some in, it's only making up for destroyed liquidity. But I don't think that's quite true because a person's get credited with more liquidity if things get better. Or they'll say, well, the GDP, we were losing trillions because people aren't working and there's real money that was destroyed. But the problem is that there's these ledgers and they're based on trust and the U.S. government's honoring of debt. And it's based on a couple of really tenuous theories. And one of them is you can stay locked down and you can pay people to work that aren't working, or you can restore capital to places that are not functioning. And it has no psychological effect on a person's willingness to get out there and risk moral hazard and go to work. And then second, it just assumes that we're never going to have any inflation and that it's okay to transfer trillions of dollars from people who spent their entire lives putting 100 a month away, 300 a month into passbook savings accounts. And then even with low inflation of maybe 2% a year, when they're getting no interest now, and they won't be for a while, they're losing their money and they're being punished for being thrifty. And by the same token, we're rewarding people that take on more debt. And then we know that that'll eventually lead to inflation. And it's really one of the largest transfers of capital in our country's history, from the middle classes to the wealthier classes and to the poorer classes. Maybe that was by design. And I think Trump's political attitude is, I can handle this. My conservatives will stay with me, but the media is tearing me apart. And if I'm cast as bloodthirsty or greedy and want to open up the economy and I'm not sympathetic and print more money, I'm going to lose. But I think maybe $1 trillion in liquidity might have been valuable, but I'm afraid that we're going to see some really bad effects. And we saw in 2008 with one of the slowest recoveries in history, if not the slowest. And the 2008 recession was over officially in June of 2009, and we should have been getting 3% GDP growth, and we weren't because the government was regulating, it was interfering, it was printing money, it was running up huge deficits, and it wasn't a good model to follow.
Speaking of the fallout from this, you and I did a show not too long before the COVID crisis started. I can't remember how long before. It may as well have been during the Eisenhower administration, the way that time is moving right now. But it was a foreign policy show in which you warned that as Iran got backed into a corner, it was likely to be more provocative and more unpredictable. And about, I think, 3 weeks after you and I had that conversation, I think we had the attempted attack on the embassy and then the strike on Soleimani. And the reason I raise this is because you recently said the same thing in print about China, that the fallout from the virus has put Beijing in a position where you expect that they're going to be more volatile vis-a-vis the rest of the world than they previously would have been. Explain what you think their thought process will be there and what you think America should be prepared for as a result.
Well, I think that when nations who have been aggressive and have been the beneficiaries of past appeasement find themselves in a crisis, they feel that the more provocative they can be, the opponent will either revert to appeasement or complacency, or they have no choice. And by that I mean China for 30 years was given a pass by the U.S. Economy and military. Now we were in a trade war with them, and they were losing, for whatever the media said, they were beginning to lose that trade war. Now their brand has been damaged. And for all their censorship, it's pretty clear that there's going to be a lot of European and American and Western industries leave Japan. And a lot of students aren't going to be able to get the expertise that they require in Western, European, and American universities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what are they going to do about it? Well, we've already seen that they're testing, they're violating some protocols of the zero-yield nuclear agreements. They're chasing American ships in international water in the South China Sea. They're cracking down and basically saying there's going to be no more democratic whispers in Hong Kong. There may not be a million Uyghurs in re-education, but maybe 1.5 million or even more. And they're surveilling their own and cracking down on their own population. So I would assume that they're going to be a lot more provocative because they feel that the status quo is not sustainable, that they're losing. And the same is true of Iran. They've been buffeted by, as we talked about earlier, the 2019 massive protests, the disgrace of shooting down the airliner and lying about it, the problems with their patron, China, their disastrous response to the virus, and there a lot of damage that was done, and most importantly, the sanctions and the embargoes on all of their trade, coupled with the crashing price of oil. And you put all that together, and if you're in the Iranian theocratic mindset, you have to provoke the United States to do something. Because again, situation as it is now, or the status quo for all of their protestations, is not sustainable. And we should be on our guard that they're going to try to lash out and somehow get us into some type of situation where geopolitically or geostrategically our allies or our enemies or somebody tries to do something to us to weaken us or to help Iran. And we've got to, when you squeeze somebody tight, you've got to make sure that they're not able to hurt you. And anybody knows from hunting that the most dangerous moment is when you wound an animal, but you don't kill it.
Now, final question for you. We've had a worthwhile reminder in the past week or so that even in the age of instant information, there sometimes remains unknowables, because there have been all kinds of conflicting reports about the health of Kim Jong-un in North Korea. Everything from he's dead and they're covering it up to he's perfectly fine and he's isolated to try to avoid COVID. He's sort of Schrodinger's dictator at this point. Yeah. So, kind of looking right now like the less dramatic scenarios there are closer to the truth, but we don't know. So just walk us through this just as a hypothetical. If you're in the White House or the Pentagon and you're operating with, say, a 35 to 40% chance that Kim is dead or incapacitated, what are the calculations like? What does that mean for the world? What does it mean for the U.S.?
Well, you'd have to factor in three or four criteria. One would be that if he is incapacitated, there's going to be a choice between his sort of lunatic sister, or I shouldn't say lunatic. And remember during the Olympics 2018, everybody gushed over her in the West because she was sort of fashionable in her outfits. But she does seem to be pretty strident like he is, and even more so because she's not incompetent. And or maybe his uncle. I guess his uncle is the only surviving son of the original Kim Jong. So my point is that if he's incapacitated, you got to be careful for a more radical, more provocative younger leader, or maybe a person who thought Kim Jong-il was incompetent and wants to dial it back. You've also got to look at the situation of China, because China's been not mortally wounded, but wounded in this entire event. And it would be in their interest to have a surrogate be provocative against the United States. Anything they can do to weaken the United States or distract the United States or get the United States off the present arc is in their interest. And so what we need to do is keep the sanctions on, be prepared that there might be a radical change in policy, or they're either more radical or more conservative. Be prepared that we're going to get stories that the embargo, the sanction, just as they did on the agreed-on framework, the six-party talks in the past, are making people eat grass, starvation, and they need humanitarian relief in a time of epidemic from the sanctions, and not yield. And I think from what Secretary Pompeo has said, it's pretty clear that he's not a Madeleine Albright, and he's not going to follow the John Kerry or Hillary Clinton model. We're going to be very tough on North Korea. And again, as in the case of China and Iran, I expect that we're going to see some type of activity as they get descend further and further into bankruptcy and to chaos.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com. He's also on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.